the Buddha, which is the Dharma, which is the Sangha. Here's a few points that, as I reflected, sat with things, came up about the most recent chapters we've talked about. First of all, when River Master is, I tried to convey again and again, and it's very hard to convey it, of course, but I tried to convey by saying that this is not the egocentric I. When River Master is talking about, like, now I am the Nyoi, now the defender of the truth, now the diamond scepter, now the dragon, now the elephant. You know, each of these representing, well, I guess the dragon's the defender of the truth, and the elephant is the saint or the, you know, the manifestation of really untroubled ongoing training, really, is what that is. Untroubled ongoing training, that is not moved by the externals and continues on course, undisturbed. And so on and so forth. When she says, now I am this, now I am that, I try to convey by use of the term not the egocentric I, what the meaning is there, but I just kind of pinged in this morning quietly. Well, maybe I should talk about it a little bit in terms of, you know, being a vessel of, and also in terms of not, you know, not being in the driver's seat. That if, I mean, the whole point of this reharmonization with the eternal is that we can live from a deeper place than self and selfish impulses. And well, what is that deeper place? Well, in the end, we have to know it through a combination of pure intuition and experience. And River Master is a very advanced place here in this process of reharmonization. And so I'd like to encourage people, when she talks like that, you can think of it in terms of being the vessel of that which is greater than yourself. And that which is great in yourself, being the eternal, being wholly good and wholly benevolent. Also, in 1998, Rinpoche Master Mokugen spoke a lot about, and subsequently spoke a lot about, you know, kind of getting kicked out of the driver's seat, which is how she experienced it in the beginning of her Kensho at that time. And that's another wonderful way of putting it. Well, if you're kicked out of the driver's seat, well, then who's in charge? You might say, you know, if the karma ain't running things, well, who's running things? The old kind of habit energy, the karma isn't running things, who's running things? Well, at the deepest level, it's really the effortless following of the eternal. Remember that wonderful place where Dogen talks about it, when the Buddha does all and we follow that doing effortlessly. And that's really what River Master is describing here, and happening, as I said, really fast teaching coming very rapidly here. But teaching coming, showing her how she is to live the rest of her life. Sometimes when the Lord calls to be the defender of the faith, when the Lord calls to be the Nyoi, which disperses the kind of seeds of compassion and wisdom, to do that. And it's at the call of the eternal, under the guidance of the eternal. It's the following. So she's giving a description of the way she's going to be living her life. And, you know, I knew her for 20 years after, as did her other disciples, for 20 years after this. And indeed, she did live her life that way. She did live her life that way, to the very best of her ability. in no way denying her own or anyone else's humanity. There's no one I ever knew more human than Reverend Master. And also no one I ever knew who I've never known who could meditate like that woman could meditate, who could hear and follow the Eternal like she could do. So the whole point of reharmonization is that we can be the vessel of something greater than self, and something greater than, of course, you know, what I've said for many years, that, you know, the so-called selfish self, you know, it's an unreality. It's the non-existent focal point of a whole bunch of karmic pain and confusion. That's the selfish self. So if we're not living from that position, if the process of conversion has gone far enough that we don't have to live from that position anymore, then what position do we live from? And that's what How to Grow Lotus Blossom is about. So she's getting a very rapid, very intense education here in the latter part of How to Grow Lotus Blossom and how to live her life. She said, you know, it began, this retreat began for her as how a Zen Buddhist prepares for death. But it turned into how a Zen Buddhist prepares for life. Another thing that I wanted to just say a few words about was the talk a little bit more about this. Well, I think it's just a wonderful fact that right at the beginning of her retreat, she hits that black lotus right in the early days of it. Hits that black lotus and that black pillar. Remember, on the lotus are the words, you know, nothing matters. And there's this black pillar, and she mustn't draw, come too close or put herself too far away, remember. And there was the lotus and the pillar were teaching at that in those early days and showing the way. And now, where we are in How to Grow Lotus Blossom, the same symbols are manifesting again. And now the lotus is golden. And now it's not something external to her, it's actually within her own hara and on her own head. And it's the same lotus, really. Enlightenment, or the teaching manifesting in the darkest place and the teaching manifesting in the brightest place. And the help and the grace, the love of the Eternal manifesting in the darkest place and the love, the grace, the help of the Eternal manifesting in the brightest place. It's all the same to the Eternal. Because an infinite love doesn't distinguish our bright and dark. It just pours itself out to help and save all beings. It's all it knows how to do. So whatever place we find ourselves, in heaven or in hell or anything in between, and anything beyond heaven and hell, there it will be. The pillar in that darkest place was the pillar of the Eternal, whether a master was fully aware of it or not. In the brightest place, it is the fifth column of light. And it, now she knows. This is the place where one, you know, gives up everything and there is the Eternal. That's that fifth column. It's the nothing matters again, actually. Because as I said before, the positive way of expressing the nothing matters, or the affirmative way, is hold fast to the Lord of the house. There is the Eternal. There is an unborn, undying refuge that is always available to us that no one and nothing can take from us. It's a real real meaning of meditation is taking refuge in that unborn, undying truth and reality that is never separate from us. Note that the color of it goes from dark, from very dark, to very bright. But that's just how we perceive it, depending on where we are in our process, in the conversion process, where we are in the harmonization process at any particular point. And there's more to it than just our perception of it. Whether we perceive it as dark or as bright, as darkness or as light, it is. And in reality, it is always unchanging. Which means that that infinite love never turns off even for an instant. I think that Billie Holiday blues Fine and Mellow. She says, love is like a faucet, it turns off and on. Something about, and then it's like, love is like a faucet, it turns off and on. Love is like a faucet, it turns off and on. Just when you think you found it, it's up and gone. Something like that, you know. Well, the eternal's not that. The love of the eternal never turns off. Our perception of it, our capacity of perception of it, to perceive it, to recognize it, that varies according to how powerful the kind of waves of karma are, the degree to which our perception is obscured or not. But it is unchanging and unvarying. It always does the best for everyone and everything. Another thing about the dark light thing is that darkness is a place of potentiality. Darkness is a place of potentiality. Darkness can be illumined. Darkness is a place of potentiality. It's not just a place of misery. It's a place of potentiality. This is a very important point in very practical ways. It can sound kind of philosophical, but it's important point in very practical ways, because one can be going through great spiritual darkness and have a profound awareness of something unfolding within oneself and of a potentiality about to be realized or in the process of being realized. And this is often the case in deeper spirituality, that the states one goes through sometimes are very dark indeed. But it's an obscurity to intellect. The Christian mystics like to talk like this. You know, obscure to intellect, but not obscure to faith. Well, they've got a good point. Dark to intellect, not dark to faith. From the point of view of faith, there's brightness within the darkness. Room Master often used to talk about this, a dark shot through with light. So don't just think of the darkness as just a kind of flat-out darkness of despair, because it's not just that. Darkness means much more than that here. One really comes to know this more and more as one goes into that shadowy hall within the hara, is drawn within the shadowy hall in the hara. And indeed, it can be very shadowy indeed. And yet, it is not in any way a negative darkness. Not in any way a negative darkness. And there one can experience the brightness within the darkness. That's the darkness of a great potentiality. A great potentiality. One is, I used the metaphor the other day of winding a spring, like winding a spring around a post. Well, while one is winding the spring around the post, it may be very dark and obscure. But when that finally one lets go and that spring starts to unwind and the merit kind of starts popping all over the place, then it's just as bright as it was dark. And that's the potential that was sensed being actualized. What is intuited is then actualized and experienced fully. This also means that there's no such thing as pointless meditation. And no such thing as pointless going through darkness in meditation. If you meditate and it's dark, just be still within the darkness and do not fight it. And just look up within it. Sometimes that darkness is shot through with pain. Sometimes it's shot through with light. It doesn't matter. Be still within it. Look up. I want to mention one particular point where Master talks about the darkness. Remember that in the, I believe it's the last chapter that I went over of Lotus Blossom, the most recent one. Where Master says that she's afraid because she senses she could go back into darkness. So she's kind of she spends a good deal, you know, a bit of time that day. I don't remember exactly how much, but some time that day, kind of in a state, kind of midpoint between heaven and earth, you might say, in the column of light. And she's afraid because she senses she might go back into darkness. Well, of course, her master's not alive now, so I can't check this with her. But I'd like to just suggest what that one possible meaning of that is. And again, because you know she's not here, I can't check this with her. So, but again, I do trust my own instincts on these things. It just kind of popped into my head. Well, I should talk a little more about this, and that it could be that darkness again is letting her, that sense of dark, of possibly going into darkness, is letting her know that this present set of experiences that she's having, that are of course so profound and so exquisite, that they are coming to a close soon. And that she will be called back into the more normal kind of bodhisattvic activity of her life and training. And I've often said, and I certainly have experienced it, every time I've been drawn into retreat, I've always at a certain point during the retreat began to realize, began to dawn on me, you know, I'm going to be coming out of this at some point. Usually in the earlier part of it, it's not even an issue at all. But at a certain point, it starts to come up. And as I understand it, it's the eternal letting you know, this isn't going to last forever. You're going to be coming out of it. And you're going to have to readjust. And I have to say, I always have anything from a mild to a very intense fear at times as I've come out of the retreat. Before I even come out of it, as I start to get that kind of message, because I actually don't have any idea how I'm going to function again in ordinary daily life, on what basis I'm going to function. In 98-99, it was the most difficult period of this type I've ever been through. In one sense, it was most difficult. In another, it wasn't, because I'd been through deep retreats before, so I knew that I was familiar by that point with the fact that you go through this concern. On the other hand, it was by far the deepest retreat I'd ever done, and I really didn't know on what basis I was going to be functioning, how functional I'd be. Indeed, it took me 5 years to get my full physical strength back from that, after that retreat. It took 5 years. And I'd never had a period of longer than a few weeks before that, or a month or 6 weeks or so before that. But this took 5 years, so that just shows how deep it had scoured me, so to speak. So that may be the meaning of that darkness. And Rim Master doesn't speculate about what it is at this point. As I said before, Rim Master was not given to speculation. But we are at the latter part of the Kensho now. And you know, the teaching experiences are coming fast and thick. But not for much longer now. Not for much longer. And it's quite an adjustment that has to be made. It's quite an adjustment. This, again, is viewing the darkness as potential, you know. And as the unknown. You know, obscure to intellect, that's yet something is coming that is sensed. A change is coming that is sensed. For now, it's not time to go into that change, but it's being sensed. You know, it's a potentiality to make more mistakes. It's also the potentiality to make merit. And no one's ever gone so far in training that it's pointless to make some merit. Another way to put it is that, you know, no one's ever gone so far in training or in enlightenment that they don't need to continue to do their training. And the total conditions within which we're doing our training, the total conditions of our life, are so complex and so in such constant flux, we're always actually being faced with the unknown. We're amazingly good at getting complacent, even right within our misery at times. We get complacent and adjust and figure, well, we can get by like this indefinitely. But no one actually gets by with anything indefinitely, because no external state of affairs stays the same indefinitely. Your body and mind are in constant change. The whole world is in constant change. This is also why the Bodhisattva vows of, you know, as Rim Master mentions, you know, the Bodhisattva vows here, and it's why they're so important, because the Bodhisattva vows don't have to do with any particular state of affairs. It's wherever the Eternal leads me, I'm following. That's the real meaning of the Bodhisattva vows. Wherever the Eternal leads, I will follow. That's what they really come down to. If you know, if I'm led into heaven, I'll go to heaven. If I'm led to hell, I'll go to hell. Because following the Eternal is an end in itself. And heaven and hell and all other states of mind and body are transitory. We're now on, I think it's plate 53. I'm not that good at reading these Roman numerals. So it's page 127, and it's a very short little chapter. It's entitled "The Real Monk." She says, "It is morning. The golden doors of my hara stand wide open. The baby Buddha stands within the golden flower." God, it's so beautiful, you know. It's just so beautiful. The golden doors of the hara, you know, that sometimes the hara is the shadowy hall. Sometimes it is the palace of the Buddha nature with golden doors. You know, what is it that's in there? The Buddha, the baby Buddha. What is the baby Buddha? What is the baby Buddha? It's our own perpetual state of being a new monk, being a new trainee. It's our own perpetual state of that wonderful first mindness, innocence and purity of mind and heart, facing the unknown, but facing it looking up and facing it with faith and with hope, with trust. You know, the purity of a little baby and the potential, always the potential to mature further in training. The little babies mature. She says, "Light streams upward from the baby Buddha to the gold-rimmed clouds and streams from them back downwards to him." The great circulation. The rising up of gratitude and love to the eternal and faith. The returning back down of the blessings of compassion and wisdom. That's the great circulation. "Another ray comes from the clouds and enters the Buddha mark upon my forehead." This is so often where the teaching comes in, is at the forehead, and where the teaching is recognized, where the truth is recognized. I've had a few times where I've just been like, either kind of like, felt like something, I kind of got something right from the forehead, or else something opened there to take in the truth. She says, "From this mark also emanates the five columns which are the five aspects of the monk. Sometimes they are separate and sometimes they form the one column within me. The lotus blossom is upon my head. Sometimes it is a golden crown." The five columns are all included within the fifth column, actually. The first four are all included within the fifth. Notice the continually changing aspects of one eternal reality. The aspects are always changing according to need, because conditions is always changing, the need's always changing. And there is the fact of the help that is there is unchanging. The oneness within difference, the difference within oneness, the light in dark, the dark in light. There's so many ways in which we speak of it. Rimu Master is experiencing it here very fully in body and mind in an exquisite way. She says, "The lotus blossom is upon my head. Sometimes it is a golden crown." She says, "Today is the first day of my life that I have ever wanted to wear a golden rock sewer or ever felt that I had the right to do so." The right to wear a golden rock sewer. Because the rock sewer is worn, and where does the rock sewer hang? It hangs right at the hara. It hangs right at the hara. And there's the golden doors are open at the hara. The Raksu, of course, is the small kesa that monks wear. And some lay trainees have a Raksu. She says, when you receive the kesa of gold brocade, it should be worn with honor and with pride. When you receive it, not one cannot take it, since one cannot steal it. Many of those who have tried to steal it, one must be given it. And Reverend Master is given it here in its true meaning. A really short chapter, but one of the real pearls of how to grow lotus blossom, this little chapter. And in the next chapters, in the coming chapters, we go through the five columns again. She is just getting round after round of teaching. There's no wasted time here. There's no wasted time. Everything that's happening has a profound meaning, and she's really just having to absorb it with her whole body and mind, taking in through her pores, as it were, this teaching. And she's being given what she needs for the rest of her life. She lived another 20 years, and what we needed, what we all needed her to be, she could be because of this teaching and of her taking it in this way. I would say I was one of the people who was at the head of the line who needed her to be what she could be at her most magnificent very shortly here. Because within a couple months of what she's experiencing here, I had my first Kensho, and I was just kind of teetering on, at this point, in November, I was just teetering on the edge of really going into some of the most intense period of some of the most intense training of my life. And, you know, although I didn't really know it at the time, of course, I was hanging on to Reverend Master for dear life, you know, at this point. Even while I had to do my own work, but she was so clearly pointing the way and so clearly grounded in the truth. The Eternal can put a person who trains as deeply as she did to such wonderful use. The Buddha, Mr. Dharma, Mr. Sangha.